This is The Conversation. It's episode 193 with Will Cotton. He is a New York-based artist, creator of various fantasies, including Candyland-based fantasies. And in case you are not familiar with him, he shows with a gallery called Mary Boone Gallery. Perhaps you've heard of that. 2, 3, 4. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where, yes, definitely recommend you go check out. Here are some things you can go check out. There's Molasses Swamp. There is a couple of my early favorites, Abandoned Churro Cabin. And then you've got the quintessential Cotton Candy, which is Cotton Candy Katie. And wait, haven't finished. There's also the infamous Root Beer Waterfall maquette. So in other words, the maquette that Will used to paint, I guess, a few of his paintings. That's a Root Beer Waterfall. It's awesome to see the maquette itself. And then finally, in a very stark contrast to the Candyland fantasies, we've got a poster for an artist talk that he gave at MICA a year ago, roughly, with a little mini graffiti underneath his name that says, "Purposefully Ignores Feminism." We talk about that and that particular experience, among many other things, coming up in a second. So before we get there, I did want to let you know, I'm pretty excited about this, and you may have already heard on the social media, but in case you haven't, a guy named Robert Grand for a art entity that you hopefully have heard of called Art Space. It's one of the big ones. He put together a piece for their lists section called 7 Art Podcasts to Feast Your Ears On. And guess who he put at the top of the list? That's right. The Conversation. Now, it's not listed as in number 1, number 2, number 3, but it's not in alphabetical order. So the fact that The Conversation is at the top, The Conversation Art Podcast is at the top, is not, I hope, accidental. So I'm very thrilled about it, and I'm so grateful that somebody gets it. And I want to let you know that Robert Grand is, in addition to being a contributor to ArtSpace, he's also a writer, not surprisingly, but he's also the co-runner of a space in Queens called Kimberly Clark. That's with a K and another K, Kimberly-Clark. So if you want to go check that out, please do. Big thanks to Robert for giving us this lovely shout out and credit. And again, I can't say enough about how great it is to be to get that sort of official acknowledgement. I'm certainly grateful for all the great comments that listeners, that you guys, some of you guys have shared. This is definitely a nice addition to that collection. So thanks again to Robert. Want to point out another shout out, the slightly odder shout out. I'll point that out on the back end. But for now, I think it's time to find out about Will Cotton and his numerous maquettes, how he makes those root beer waterfalls, and so much more. So let's get into that conversation. I will talk to you more on the back end. Thank you very much for being here. Talk to you then. All right, great. Well, here's my favorite place to start. So you're in Tribeca. We can say that, correct?
True.
How long have you been there?
I've been here since 2010.
Oh, wow. So you're a newbie, as it were.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
I'm very much a newcomer.
Right,
yeah, the
okay.
rest of my building, they've all been here since 74, 75.
Wow, okay. And where were you before Tribeca?
I was on the Lower East Side for 13 years prior.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
Over on Allen and Grand.
Did you get more space in Tribeca? Was that kind of one of the reasons that you wanted to move?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean that, and like I thought I should actually try to buy something one of these days.
Right.
I should say this is with my girlfriend, Rose. And we thought we could find something on the Lower East Side. And it was so expensive.
Right.
And you'd think Tribeca would not be the more yeah. affordable option.
Right.
But in fact, I mean, it was one of those things. We'd been looking for a year and a half, and we got super lucky. You know, a seller that really needed to sell.
Right. That's interesting. So I lived in Manhattan myself many years ago, and I don't know how relevant this is, but I met an artist who had a huge loft space in Tribeca that he was renting. It was kind of the same deal. He just like did a lot of homework, knocked on a lot of superintendents' doors and what have you, and he just found this place. And it was like, you know, yeah. below market, and it was this huge place. So I don't know, you know, maybe there's some kind of thing in Tribeca where everybody assumes that it's a fortune, and you guys found that.
You know, a couple of galleries have been moving in just recently, and I think they'll be followed by others. And this is galleries that were in Chelsea.
Right.
And I think they're finding the space down here more beautiful and more affordable.
Yeah, interesting. So the subtext of asking you about how long you've been in Tribeca is, you know, about how it's changed, of course. And you've probably seen a change, I would imagine, just in the last 7 years. But my presumption is still that it's a lot quieter than a place like the Lower East Side. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. It's quieter than any place I've ever been in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. It's really nice.
That's great.
I like it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we could never have done this interview at the old place without like a lot of honking and bus noises and all kinds
right.
of stuff.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. What is that like? I mean, you can either address it as far as your lifestyle / your general quality of life and or your work, going from a place where you've got all those external sounds to relative quiet.
I noticed a kind of funny thing I wasn't expecting. I had the same place. I've always done live work, so it's mm-hmm. the same place, same studio. And, it had been this Lower East Side place that was gritty, you could say. And the other thing I'll mention is that it was a commercial space. I had gotten into this thing just prior to that in the 90s of trying to find commercial spaces to rent where I thought the landlord would be willing to look the other way about me actually living there.
Mm.
And so that was what kept me going for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like I had to build a kitchen and the bath, and they were rudimentary and makeshift. And something about that place, like it made me like want to dream about another place. You know, it was good. I was really happy to have it, but like, In the work I was doing, which involves a lot of fantasizing about a great place,
mm-hmm.
It really came naturally there in a way that once I got here to Tribeca, I didn't feel the same way. It just, like, the space is so beautiful and I feel just lucky to be here. But in terms of making work that is somewhat escapist in nature,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't feeling that at first in this new place.
Right. And then you did.
Yeah, I think I did. I think the work's also shifted some since then, to be honest.
Mm. Well, before we get into the work or anything in that area, so have you always had live work or most of the time?
Yeah, I should say most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period, early, mid-90s, when trying to figure out how to make some money as usual.
Mm-hmm.
I developed some building skills from building out the place I had at that time on Broadway. And so with a friend of mine, we got together and we thought up this idea because everyone we knew was looking for studio space. We thought, let's rent a big space, break it up into small spaces, and sublet those out, and in the meantime, we can each take some space in the building. So that mm-hmm. we did that. We borrowed money from his mom and mm-hmm. promptly paid her back because mm-hmm. it turned out to be a smart thing to do. We rented the spaces pretty easily, and that, you know, I had a separate space for that period. until it got rented.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Which was enough to remind me that I just don't like doing that. It's mostly for me the commute. I don't want to have to commute. I like just waking up in it.
Right. Right. And I'm sure over the years people have played devil's advocate against you as far as not having a distance from your work and that kind of thing, and that's just never been an issue, I assume.
I don't think so. You know, I can see their point. Mm-hmm. I certainly have heard that. But I think at this point in my life, I mean, going pretty far back now, I've had which to me means that I work like standard business hours, meaning that then I have the evenings free to go out and do stuff that other people do in the evenings.
Right.
I had played around prior to that with working like all night,
mm-hmm.
sleeping during the day,
mm-hmm.
you know, all kinds of other ways. But this one really worked for me.
So business hours, like nine to five-ish, more or less?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nine to five. Maybe 8:30 to 6:30 sometimes,
right.
You know. But mm-hmm. the main thing is like not really going beyond 6:30, because it's when I was just listening to your interview with Sarah Kane, your conversation with Sarah Kane, talking about the importance of being social, of forcing oneself to be social in the art world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I did find that to be true early on. And so to have those hours, like to go to openings and, mm-hmm. you know, later on at the gallery dinners and so on.
Right.
That schedule made that make sense.
Right. How is it being habitually live work, you know, and not having to commute, and also to a certain extent not having to go out? How does it make it in some ways, like if you're working till, let's say you're working maybe a longer day in the evening and there's mm-hmm. an event that maybe you're like middling about going to, you know, mm-hmm. will the the momentum maybe keep you in the studio sometimes? Or did you decide at a certain point, I have to go?
You know, it only will, honestly, if there's some kind of external deadline imposed. Otherwise, I'm very good at just saying that's enough and,
mm-hmm.
you know, washing my brushes, putting them away.
Right.
That's kind of an end of the day ritual. And then I'm just done.
Yeah.
Really.
And where are you on the introvert, extrovert spectrum as far as, you know, being naturally
definitely
inclined?
Natural introvert.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
I mean, I think a lot of us artists probably don't go into this because we're social butterflies.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a thing that I enjoy doing as a teenager, as a way of not being around anybody at all.
Right.
And, you know, the big rude awakening I think a lot of us get when you come to New York is that actually, if you ever want anyone to know about the work you're doing, you have to get out there and learn to be social. And so
yeah,
I think I have. It's been a long, slow process. But I'm much less uncomfortable in social situations than I used to be.
Right. Well, this raises for me the arc of which we can get into maybe in another from another angle as well, but the arc of success in terms of your career and how the pressure you maybe put on yourself to be out there has changed, if at all. You know, in other words, the question I suppose would be something like, if you became successful enough at a certain point where you had representation, you know, and you were showing basically every year and the gallery was doing that sales work for you, to what extent did you feel like you could tone down the socializing?
Honestly, I thought when I started showing with Mary Boone in 1999,
mm-hmm.
my fantasy vision of that was that I didn't have to do anything anymore but work in my studio.
Right.
And it turned out not to be true. Like, there's actually a lot, you know, to just stay on the radar in New York, you have to show up, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you talk about that? I mean, like, how does that play out? What are the various iterations of being present, even when your work is present?
Right. It's something I've had to figure out, because naturally, I don't understand it. You know, I go see a show and like, that's all I need. I don't need any kind of song and dance from the artist.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to not be the case for a lot of collectors, even curators and critics.
Mm-hmm.
The FaceTime matters to a lot of people. You know, the biography matters. And I can understand it now. You know, it enriches the experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. That's something I had to learn, because it's just not the case for me.
Yeah. Well, how much of that is your gallery setting up, you know, inviting you on collectors' behalf to, you know, their dinners or something along those lines versus more of a random being out there?
You know, probably more of the former in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know that many people, but, you know, it quickly became a thing where I just saw that it helped a lot if I had met collectors. And, you know, physically, the way that was happening for me was actually largely going to other friends' openings and, you know, little by little. It's a small enough art world here that you really get to know most of the players.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying, like, I get all the big invitations. I certainly don't. But, mm-hmm. you know, when I do, I think it's worthwhile. And they tend to build on each other. You know, you show up at a couple of, you know, museum benefit dinners and you meet some people there, and then they wind up inviting you to other stuff, and it does that. And, you know, I found that an artist has kind of a special access to things that would be otherwise way beyond our means, like, you know, eating fancy dinners all the time, and, you know, getting invited to go stay in nice places, even doing residencies, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's a different kind of like social economic mobility that, you know, I suppose is not a real one, but, you know, it feels like it.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because I would wonder maybe at some point since 1999 that you maybe without any kind of fanfare crossed over from, you know, this artist who's getting access to situations he wouldn't otherwise have to sort of being almost part of that other side in a certain way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I suppose to an extent. I mean, it's all so relative.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, I don't feel that I lack right now. But it's, you know, I also don't feel like, let's say I throw a dinner for a few people here, I feel like I can call up the caterer and, you know, do that level stuff. It's still, you know, just my own way of doing things.
Right.
You know, the people I'm talking about, as I heard you say, like we are talking about the 0.1% or even the 0.01%,
right,
which makes up a really big part of the collector base in New York.
Right.
That's just, it's a level that's so far beyond.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to go with my instincts here, and this isn't something provocative per se, but when you when you use those phrases and you mentioned the 0.01% and, you know, the collectors and so on, I thought of, this documentary that I was watching recently about, Bill, I'm going to blank on his name, but the guy who's challenging Herbalife, you know, the hedge fund guy who's shorting Herbalife stocks. I thought of him, and then I thought of, and then I just went ahead and thought of Stephen Cohen. And I guess I just wonder, you know, are any of your collectors big hedge fund guys?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think those two are my collectors.
Okay.
But yeah, I'd say that's at least a dominant, if not a majority.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And what do you find any kind of through line with their personalities, would you say?
I'd like to say no. I feel like everyone is kind of in it for a different reason. I think the expectation there is that they're all a bunch of money-focused people that don't have any real interest in art, and that hasn't been what I've found. I've definitely found really passionate art collectors whose money is coming from hedge funds. Yeah, no, it's the ones I know anyway, they've all seemed like their own thing.
Right. Well, is there any kind of collector that maybe that you are most wary of? Without mentioning any names, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a lot of snobbery about that. Like, if someone really likes my work and wants to get it, I like that. I think that's a good person.
Right.
I know there are artists out there who've had this experience of collectors buying and flipping their work at auction and playing around with that sort of market thing.
Right.
I think it's partly because I make so little work that has not happened to me a ton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pieces go out to auction, but it's not like anyone's generally making a ton of money on that. I don't think it's even tempting for them.
Okay, well, that certainly raises the that certainly begs clarification. When you say you make very little work, how do you define that?
6 or 8 paintings a year.
Okay, that is pretty modest. That is pretty modest. So then they're rather time intensive. Is that true?
They are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it takes me. I mean, on average, I guess 1.5 to 2 months. To do a painting, and my studio is really super bare bones. It's just me. Emily, who you spoke to, is at the desk and handles, you know, all that stuff. But in the studio, painting, it's just
right, it's
me
just you
doing my thing.
Yeah, got it.
So it's not the kind of production where I could even ramp it up because I think there's so much demand or something. It's just, it's comfortable, and I keep it that way because I honestly have seen artists I know becoming managers, you know, and that's, again, I didn't get into it to be a manager,
right?
You know, coordinating other people to do the stuff that I actually like to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So, have you noticed in some of these friends that, you know, that they've become a little less, themselves or less happy, you know, having transformed from being artists to being managers, leaders.
That's how it appears to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I can think of one who I've spoken to, who I won't name, who's, you know, recently changed that around, got rid of all the studio assistants and gone back to just straight up painting.
Wow. Interesting.
And seems pleased with that decision.
Mm. That's unusual that somebody would go and switch directions like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you my Will Cotton story, which is not really a story, but at least it will give you some specificity. So when I was living in Manhattan, I was working my before I left the city. My last day job, I think, was on Fifth Avenue and like 40 something Street, and I invited a coworker, and I can't remember if I saw your show at Mary Boone before or if I just had a sense of what it was going to be. But I invited this coworker, who was not a huge art person, but I said, we should go check out the show. And so it was your, I guess, 2000 maybe show of paintings there. And she was pretty into it. And I think there was something about the light and, there, you know, there's just something about the fantasy taken to such a artful and, you know, over the top way that I think I sensed would be something that, you know, a coworker who's, you know, not an art primitive or a you know, what have you, but, you know, somebody who's not a regular art looker would appreciate. And she did.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's just that's basically just a way of leading into I either read at the time or maybe earlier about your setting up these still lives or these, you know, sort of aquariums or what have you. So what you want to tell listeners about, you know, the evolution of start, we could get into the evolution maybe in a bit, but maybe if you could just start by talking about how you construct these still lives that you paint from.
Sure. I would refer to them as tabletop maquettes.
Okay.
Just because I did still life painting when I was much, much younger. And it's wonderful, and it's really its own thing. In the things I was building, the whole idea is that you can look at it and experience a scale shift. So I was generally building these things at eye level.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you're right in the sense that it's still life size, you know. So it's, I mean, these things might have been like 2 by 3 feet or, you know, sometimes as big as 4 by 6 feet wide and then as, however tall they needed to be. But they were made at eye level so that they just felt like landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you how I got into that was a little brief backstory. I was in the early 90s, I was painting a lot of advertising icons, things like the Nestle Quick Bunny and Twinkie the Kid,
mm-hmm.
the Hamburglar,
mm-hmm.
And putting these into a kind of scenario. I felt like this was the pantheon of characters that made sense to me as opposed to the Judeo-Christian tradition of painting and or mythological subject, which, you know, you could learn about the, I guess, the importance and symbolism of those people, but it didn't feel natural. But when I said something like the Hamburglar, that felt to me like a real cultural point,
mm-hmm.
that my peers would understand without having to have studied theology or
right.
mythology.
Right.
So I'm diverging a bit. I was doing that, and then I came across the Candyland board game, and it took me back to when I was a kid, and it really reminded me of being, in my mind, in this place. And so I made a painting directly off the board, you know, really copying this illustrator's hand and making it into a big painting. And I got really excited about it, while at the same time I felt really critical that everything that was good about this was good because this illustrator did it and I have this nostalgic reference to it,
mm-hmm.
and which doesn't feel like enough to me.
Right.
So I started thinking, how can I make this my own? And that's when I started building maquettes, because I thought, well, what would it really look like? And, you know, I knew already from doing a lot of realist still life and landscape painting prior to that, that there's nothing like observation to make something interesting.
Right.
If I make something up out of my head, it's going to tend to be stylized and broken down to its really most symbolic elements,
mm-hmm.
But not have that surprise that you get when you're looking at the actual thing.
Right.
So I thought, okay, I got an oven, which I just had recently purchased,
mm-hmm.
And I'll just start baking cakes and piling them up in mm-hmm. the studio, which I did, and mm-hmm. then I started sticking, you know, lollipops and various things in it, till it started looking to me like a landscape that, you know, maybe this is outside the Candyland board game, maybe this is the other thing you find next.
Right.
And that was a huge moment for me. It's the first time in my life when I felt like I had a working method that was straight up useful for me, you know, that opened the doors wide up.
Right.
Because it was no longer me thinking, you know, I like to paint and going around and looking for something to paint. Like, now I could build the whole thing. I could build it with whatever symbolism I was interested in built into it. And also then look around, you know, what I thought was the backside of it maybe, and be surprised that that's really interesting. So, you know, like you would in a real landscape.
Yeah. Let me just jump in for a second. To go back to the original distinction you made between still life and maquette. Yeah, I didn't mean to, and I understand how using the still life maybe in this context is a little minimizing perhaps, or certainly misses kind of the scope of it. I guess I was just using it as a stand-in, you know, for setting some things up essentially. But to clarify though, as just as far as the logistics, I mean, do I remember right that I read that you actually use like a fish tank or something like that? Because, and if not, how do you set it up so that you have like these bodies of water or liquid?
Right. I think the first really liquidy one I did was, it was my take on the molasses swamp, which was an area of the Candyland board game, you know, back when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I had a basin. And within that basin, I built things. I built you know, like I said, I had some basic carpentry skills, so mm-hmm. I built up a platform around it, and onto that platform I built some hills, and under the hills I put a bunch of melted chocolate and various other things, and then I was using, I think, what is it called, Baby Ruth uh-huh. stick candies as, uh-huh. as you know, kind of milkweeds or something in the swamp. So, you know, it had a liquid element. The next phase from there for me, in terms of engineering complexity, was this chocolate waterfall I did. And that had to circulate chocolate from the basin up to the top of the waterfall and right. around and around again.
Right.
And, yeah, that. I forgot where we started.
Well, tell, how was that? Did that involve consulting, you know, plumbers and what have you, or did you just manage to figure it out by yourself?
You know, when I moved into the first loft that I ever renovated for myself, mm-hmm. I think this probably has to do with me having a hard time asking for help. I went to the bookstore and I got a Time Life book on how to renovate, you know, how to do plumbing and electric. Mm. Hang drywall, mm-hmm. and I just learned everything from that book. And so, you know, when it comes to doing these engineering things, I did it the same way. I just like looked up whatever I could find, and you know, went to the stores where I know they sell pumps and that sort of equipment, and talked right. to the people, and then just did it.
Right. Did you happen to ever have an experience where you're setting this? I mean, I guess being that it's a private studio, it's maybe unlikely, but where maybe somebody happened to be, I don't know, delivering something, or, you know, a friend of a friend, you know, maybe was over and like wondering what the hell you were doing, that kind of scenario?
Yeah, I mean, it happened a lot more later when I had, you know, people laying around in cotton candy and that sort of thing. But I'll tell you, with one of the waterfall pieces, I did a root beer waterfall, mm-hmm. and at that time I was in this place on the Lower East Side that was above a print shop. Mm-hmm. Not art prints, but like Chinese menus and that sort of stuff.
Right.
And the whole thing, I think because of the carbonation in the root beer, it was really malfunctioning a lot. Mm. And in the end, it wound up leaking a lot, like gallons onto the floor. But I didn't want to pay attention to that because I was really trying to get good video footage of this thing while it was working. And so as this was going on, I eventually got a knock on the door, like a really loud, aggressive knock. And it was the guy from the print shop. Because there was root beer leaking down right onto the printing press and like destroying everything they were making. And I think he looked really surprised to find the source of it.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awfulsome. Well, I have to ask this sooner or later, so I might as well ask it now. Have your dentist seen your work?
My current dentist, no.
Okay.
No, he has not seen my work. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I, if the question is leading toward, you know, has my own dental health, it's I think, pretty average. I do eat a lot of sweets.
Right.
Something that I think plays into it, but it's not, like, the reason that I like to use that as a symbol and a metaphor in painting.
Right.
I feel like that's a separate thing. I also do happen to love sweets.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But I take good care of my teeth.
Good. Yeah. And have you since a certain point where store bought candies were not enough, you know, like you mentioned the mm-hmm. piling up the cakes. I mean, was that kind of the genesis of the baking for your maquettes?
That's true. It was. In fact, that very piece, like mm-hmm. it required, I got a cookbook.
Right.
And I'm sure if this were now, I'd be learning these things all on YouTube. But that was the way I did back then. And you know, having that skill, I think, again, you know, like being the one who's here who actually knows how to paint and everything, it just makes my eyes much more wide open to what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So once I knew that I could bake cakes, you know, I went through and I baked whatever I thought I might need. Really until I got to mackerel, and that one was tougher. I
making your own macaroons?
Yeah, like Parisian macaroons, you know, they're very colorful little cookies.
Right.
And they've played a pretty big part in the work, and it's one of those things that you really have to get a feel for doing it properly. And that was the first cooking class I took here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
was how to do those.
And what was the rationale for learning to make your own macaroons as opposed to just buying them?
Oh, well, cost.
Yeah.
I wanted to build a macaron forest that would, you know, it involved probably like 1,000 cookies.
Wow.
And they're not inexpensive. And in fact, at the time, there was no Lotterie here yet. You know, they were pretty unusual.
Yeah, right, right.
Very unusual. I think Maison de Chocolat had a few. But it was not a big thing like it's become.
I see.
And so I took that class. And in fact, after that was done, I still wasn't, you know, up to the level I felt I needed to be to make this maquette. And I wound up, you know, essentially talking the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
doing a story on me going to Paris to learn to make macaron from the pastry chef at Lotterie, the head chef. And in order to actually get to do that, and they went for it, and I did. And
you pitched a story in which you were a traveling chef or rather a novice chef on a mission to learn a new skill.
I did.
That's awesome.
I did, and not a chef/artist because
right.
I think they would have sent another chef if it were just that.
Right,
yeah.
An artist/chef. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I did.
And what was that? How was that trip?
That was amazing. The Times at that time had an arrangement with the Ritz,
mm-hmm.
where they would get really cheap rooms and put their writers up there. So stayed at the Ritz, and you know, I got to eat lots of sweets and
wow.
learn stuff. It
right,
was, yeah,
that's awesome.
That's what I love to do. Yeah.
So here's another very practical and perhaps a bit tedious question about the baked goods and other ephemera and sweets from your maquettes. What happens to them when you're finished with the still life? Are they presumably by the time that you're finished painting them or photographing them, they're already stale, or what's the arc?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of them being beyond edible, that's usually the case. The gingerbread houses were the exception because they really last a while, and mm-hmm. I actually love eating gingerbread houses, so they would get painted first and then eaten later.
Right.
And in the beginning, my policy was to keep absolutely everything,
mm-hmm.
In part because I liked watching them decay,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that might come into the work, and eventually it did a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, and again, this is the old place on Allen and Grand.
Right.
There's one day when I had, like, these cakes, and they had a real hard shell frosting on them. It was made with royal icing, which just gets like plaster. And then eventually the thing under its own weight cracked.
Mm.
And through that crack, where the cake should have been, it was this writhing mass of larvae.
Ooh.
That turned out to be moth larvae, and which were eating my clothes. And,
oh, my goodness.
So that, it was just really honestly one of the grossest things I've ever seen. And,
did you videotape that by any chance?
For keeping everything.
I'm sorry, did you videotape that by any chance? The unveiling of the larva?
No, I did not. It was, you know, very much in the moment. No cell phone cameras.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, that does remind me, though, going back several minutes when you did mention uh-huh. that you were videotaping the root beer, cycling through. Is there any part of the process where you actually are painting from video, or what's the rationale for the video?
There was at that time.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I was always trying to make it like it's a plein air painting experience for me.
Right.
So, I'm standing at the edge of Niagara Falls, like Frederick Church, and painting pictures of it.
Right.
That was the fantasy I wanted to engage in.
Right.
And so I thought, I can't have this thing running constantly because it basically destroys itself
right.
over the course of a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
So let me, and in that case, I asked a friend who was, you know, professional video guy, would he come over and set up a camera for me to shoot this thing? And he did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't something that seemed like art to me in itself, you know, which I'm always open to. Like, if there's some stage where I think, no, that's it, it's done. But it didn't. It wasn't that interesting. But it was great to paint from on a television.
Right. Interesting. Okay, so what was it that was going on in your mind that led you to decide to introduce live models into your scenarios?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the way I've always approached painting, honestly, is to follow a kind of thread. I've never been a person that like plans my next series of paintings and then just executes them. I just I make a painting and I look at it then like an observer, mm-hmm. and I think what questions is this bringing up? You know, where is it pointing to?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, this was about 2002, and I had noticed myself making all these structures that referenced architecture, you know, gingerbread houses, you know, candy trailer houses, things that had doors and windows and pathways. And I thought, you know, there's a question I'm not answering, which is who lives here? You know, why are these things built like this?
Right.
You know, which at that point could be anything from a gingerbread man, I suppose, to real people.
And, mm-hmm.
Around that same time, I had become interested in American pinup painting, as a genre. And I think my attraction to that was similar to my attraction to candy and sweets and everything over the top in terms of desserts, that pinup painting is this kind of over the top, ridiculous sexuality. You know, it's, as opposed to like porn the way it is now, it was, I think much fluffier and sweeter, and it to me had a lot to do with the way I was making these paintings of landscapes and architectural structures.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that would be a good pairing, and that's the way I approached it in the beginning. It was, I'd people in this kind of pinup-y way.
Right, right. And perhaps the, you know, without getting too editorial about it, the quintessential sort of pairing of your sweets with a model is like the cotton candy, the girl laying down in front of the cotton candy background or something along those
exactly.
lines. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
yeah.
agree.
So, I guess on a practical level, how long do the models sit? I mean, is it just the kind of thing where you get the background set up, they come in and you shoot and then they're done? Or is it, will you ever do a longer take?
You know, to be honest, these days it's pretty much what you just described. It's
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
It's evolved in that direction from having models come in and sit for much longer.
Right.
And I was always afraid to let go of that because I've never enjoyed what people call photorealism or even photo-based painting all that much.
Right.
So I didn't want working from photographs to make my work suddenly look like that. So
I
really held on to the, you know, having a living, breathing model for as long as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to be working with people that didn't have the time. And I started using a level of detail that just wasn't going to be really nice for anybody to sit for like 2 months.
Yeah.
I mean, I know other painters do it, but I couldn't. But what I've done, you know, to make that feel right to me is I've maintained this practice of drawing from the live model almost weekly in the studio. I have someone come in for 3 hours and
mm-hmm.
I just draw from life.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like because I know drawing and painting from that point of view that I can put something that feels to me, you know, extra beyond photographic and into the work that I do.
Right. Right. So at one point early on, then you had models who were sitting for a couple months at a time, even.
I did in school situations. I did a month long pose 5 days a week, and that was just an amazing experience. In my studio now, it'd be more like, you know, a week or so.
Oh, okay, got it.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if, you know, I just want to honor something that I'm wondering, which is mm-hmm. when you're working with the candy fantasy land, you know,
yeah,
maquette scenarios, mm-hmm. there's something about that as much as it, you know, might sort of fall into the category of still life, if you will, that when you introduce a model into it, it enters much more into the dialogue of portraiture and nudes and so on. Has that distinction come to mind for you in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it made a difference in practice because suddenly I had to scale everything up. You know, instead of being tabletop maquette size, now it has to be like human size, more like building props for a set.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened. And then in terms of content, you know, it in my mind, like my point of reference has pretty much always been art historical. So even when I'm painting these piles of suites, I'm painting them as landscapes, and I'm thinking of them in the tradition of landscape painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's on a canvas, it's rectangular on the wall, and there is, you know, foreground, middle ground, background space. It's something, you know, there's so many landscape painters I've looked at, but let's just say some of the Impressionists, Monet,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Sure.
I'm thinking of it in that thread back to Monet, like this is the thing I want to make a reference to. So when I came to painting figures into it, I'm still looking at a lot of the same kind of references. Like I'm still walking around the museum in my mind, and now I'm seeing, you know, figure paintings, which have this tradition, honestly, being mostly commissioned portraiture.
Right.
So I wanted to, you know, take some of that on. I mean, I'm getting a little ahead now of just first introducing them, though. In the beginning, they were really, you know, for example, when I did the one of the girl on the cotton candy cloud, I was very specifically looking at this painting by Alexandra Cabanel called The Birth of Venus,
mm-hmm.
in which she's on a wave in a similar reclining position.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, again, here's the thread from 19th century painting through American mid-century pinup art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, living in our, I guess, postmodern thought world, I don't feel like there's a hierarchical problem with, you know, putting her in cotton candy and it, you know, and making that it's still a serious painting. Like I'm not joking. It's just something that makes sense
mm-hmm.
in that lineage.
Right. Right. Well, I don't know if this question or this wondering is should be brought up in the context of the history of pinup or not. But when you with some of the images, and I'm going to preface this by saying that I am certainly playing devil's advocate to a large degree
sure.
here, but the question of exploitation or exploitative elements, you know. I mean, I assume these are things that you've certainly considered through the process, but maybe a better way of getting at this angle is, you know, what kind of feedback you've gotten in that regard.
Oh, yeah, I've gotten that kind of negative feedback that's really taken me by surprise.
Okay.
And only because, you know, in my process to get there, my mental process,
mm-hmm.
Like as all the things I'm checking off, exploitation is not one of them, you
right.
know, nor is like diminishing the value of the feminine form or you know, anything that it seems like, especially now it's coming across that way.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm some kind of anti-feminist.
Right.
It's just not true.
Right.
You know, I actually went pretty deep into looking into that when I was attacked by this group of art students during a slide lecture I gave.
Can you please describe the full scenario there, if you don't mind?
Sure. Yeah. So this was at MICA in Maryland.
Right. Right.
Standard visiting artist gig for your audience. I'll just describe that. It
mm-hmm.
means I'm paid some money to come down for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And do a PowerPoint lecture, followed by studio visits.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, at MICA, what they like to do is get everyone together at the end of the day, just before I go back to get on the train, and have what they call a really informal discussion just on this bunch of couches in a really informal setting. And you know, the whole time I thought that's the part I want to do. You know, that's the fun part, really,
right.
Just talking to artists one-on-one like that.
Right.
So we sit down to do this thing, and a hand goes up, like, yeah, thinking we're going to probably talk about technique, for example, or materials or something. And, you know, it's a very challenging question about me. I always forget the wording. I know I should know this. You know, being exploitative of women. How was it that they said that? Like, essentially, the reading that they had of my paintings was that I'm equating women with frivolous things to be consumed.
Right.
That by putting a woman in a context with other candies and things like that, that the message is, you know, this paradise is full of my male fantasies of consumption.
Right.
And with the woman acting as no more than another consumable object.
Right.
So it's a kind of objectification. And the thing about that reading is I can't argue with it. I mean, I totally look at the paintings now and I see what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I thought, does this mean I need to correct something?
Mm-hmm.
And I spent I guess 2 or 3 months after that visit reading up on feminist literature, you know, primarily excerpts that I was finding online and trying to, you know, get a sense of whether I was doing something out of ignorance, you know, because it had come as a surprise to me. I thought maybe I am a horrible person and I'm just like not aware of it. It seems plausible. And I'm not actually saying I am or I'm not a horrible person, but I do understand the criticism.
Uh-huh.
But the end result for me, I mean, that, you know, the other thing they attacked me on was like being heteronormative and very white in my choice of subjects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, I know what they want me to do. I know what I should do right now. I should probably paint some trans people and more women of color. I mean, I think they didn't know that I had done that a bunch. And, you know, and so on. Do what in these times seems to be the right thing to do. And it's just like I could not motivate myself to even go as far as sketching those ideas. I just thought, that's not what this is about.
Right.
And meaning it's not what this is about for me.
Right.
You know, because at the end of the day, as I saw there, like there's nothing I can do. Once a piece goes out there, it's got its life. And, you know, people talk about it as though that reflects directly back on me. But I think the important thing about that really is that it's triggering discussions, love, hatred.
Yeah.
And I don't have to edit myself. I don't have to censor myself because I feel like, you know, the ideas I have are inappropriate.
Right. This was fairly recently, this Micah visit, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think this was, God, was it this past spring or the one before? I'm getting so bad with that.
Definitely in the last 18 months in any case. So,
oh, yeah, for sure.
So definitely in this, while not necessarily in the post-election moment, certainly in a in a troubled moment nonetheless, or a very, you know, a PC moment, if for lack of a more complicated description.
Yeah, yeah certainly.
Yeah. I guess I just want to make a couple of quick points.
Mm-hmm.
One is that two sort of one sort of supportive and one of you, and one maybe a little supportive of them. And that is, I think the suggestion that your work is too heteronormative, and that you're why are you painting these white things? Well, you are white, I presume,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
You know the suggestion that you should the implication that you should be painting these things that are much more. Culturally sensitive, you know, representing the disenfranchised and so on. I mean, that's the kind of thing where you can be disinterested in somebody's work because it does not address those things. But to suggest that somebody do it just seems completely ridiculous to me.
Right. I think that the ultimate criticism after I responded to all the others was just that, well, at least by continuing to do this, I'm being complicit in being part of the problem.
Right.
This idea of complicitness.
Right.
Complicity.
Right.
You know, and then that's hard to argue, like, I guess so. But so I need to raise my social awareness and channel that into my art. And, you know, I really gave that a fair go as like maybe that's the case. But it just, in a lot of soul searching, it's absolutely not the case.
Right.
And it's not my responsibility to be working on their social issues and our social issues, frankly, as a society. I have no problem with that. But, you know, what I'm painting is a fantasy.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to paint things as they are. I'm not trying to paint a real picture
right.
of the exact nature of society right now.
Right. It is art as escapism.
And I don't have to be.
To a certain extent.
I'm sorry?
I said it is art as escapism mm-hmm. to a certain degree.
Yeah. I mean, I hesitate to use that word, even though I know I did, just because I think there's more to it than that. I think
mm-hmm.
I'm allowing myself to just... to make art that I feel passionate about making. And
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have to be like a researched history paper or
right.
gender studies paper. I don't need to do any of that stuff. I need to make a good painting. And, you know, as you know, that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And the only barometer for that is like, can I get myself excited about something I just did? You know, does it feel meaningful to me? I don't want to do anybody else's agenda.
Yeah.
And God, there's this great quote. I'm very sorry, I won't remember the correct attribution, but something to the effect that our fantasies are never politically correct.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point. Well, you know, I hope this doesn't end up being wildly inappropriate, at least in the context of what you just said. But I'm just going to mention what came into my head, which is one thing that Dan Savage, you know, who the well-known advice columnist, among other things,
yep.
is he talks about how when people call up or write in with these bizarre fantasies that they have. You know, and they're worried that they're perverts or much worse. He says, you know, these are your fantasies. You're not actually doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's relevant to what you're talking
about. I mean, the
other
thought I have about that is mm-hmm. that, and I've actually looked into this quite a bit in terms of just brain physiology. These things are coming out of a part of your brain, you know, the amygdala,
mm-hmm.
that... you don't have any control back over. Like it's a one-way kind of communication from there that gets passed along to your higher brain, and then you can analyze it and think about it and try to justify it. But the feeling you had, the excitement you had over something, is in another place. So all you have to do at that point is deal with it. Like, oh my God, I want this thing that seems inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And then how am I going to handle that? It reminds me a lot of when I first started getting so excited about painting this imagery. If I can digress a little,
sure.
I was in a very hedonistic, druggy kind of period of my life at that time. I was really living at night, and we're talking here mid-90s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was curious about, genuinely, like, how far can you take this? How much could you just try to live for pleasure? And I really, you know, at some point, probably the drugs took over and then it just wasn't a choice anymore. But that's what I felt like I was exploring. And that's what made me start painting these visions of, you know, Candyland and so on.
Can you indulge us in some of those details? You know, what drugs were you indulging
right.
in and so on? What was your lifestyle like?
It was going out to clubs and parties at night
mm-hmm.
and drinking vodka and doing cocaine.
Okay.
That was my thing.
Got it.
And mm-hmm. in the meantime, you know, not being a person of means, going into debt and living in otherwise kind of substandard ways. You know?
Did the vodka and cocaine make you more of an extrovert?
Yes. Yes, they did. And that was one of my early attempts to make that work.
Right.
I mean, following just using alcohol to make that work.
Right.
Oh my God, the first time I did it, I thought, holy shit, this is what I've been missing my whole life. You know, now I can go and talk to people and I'm not the least bit afraid.
Right, right.
No more social anxiety. And, you know, there's probably a moment when that was actually a viable means of getting there. It was working for a little bit.
Right.
You know, in the end, I had to quit everything, which is now about 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I've had to remain, and it's been great for me, too.
Are you in a support group?
But I, at the same time, I don't regret having gone through that and experimented with it.
Right. Are you in a support group or two?
Yeah, I go to a Cocaine Anonymous meeting once a week.
Wow. And the other thing I want to ask you about that is, did you have people who knew you sort of during that period or before and after describe how that your personality changed during that period?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the people I was hanging out with then is they were all just like me. So with my quitting and them not quitting,
mm-hmm.
I just seemed less fun.
Right.
You know,
right.
That was the change. But, you know, I think... There are also people I know still from back then, and I don't know. I guess it's hard to ever know really what impression one is making.
Right.
Like,
well, I mean, like, do you have a lifelong friend that knew you before and after,
yes,
and during that period maybe found you a little noxious or what have you?
No, the friend was really going there with me.
Okay.
If there was a person in my life that wasn't doing that, mm-hmm. they just were not in my life.
Right.
You know, I was only interested in hanging around that.
Right.
Which also, you know, incidentally really normalizes the whole thing too.
Mm-hmm. One thing going back to the newts or the models rather, in your work, as you were describing the questions or accusations around exploitation is that in thinking, as you were talking about that, in thinking about them, I recall that they're very unsexualized. I mean, they're you know, in the sort of classic kind of pinup tradition, but there's nothing sort of, you know, despite being in the context of things that we want to savor and devour, you know, the models themselves are not sexualized. They're very sort of traditional.
Absolutely, and that's been a real conscious choice from the beginning because mm-hmm. I think... you know, sexuality could easily command the day and take over the scene entirely.
Right.
If that's part of it.
Right.
Like hardcore, full-on, direct
right.
sexuality.
Right.
And, you know, I know there are painters who work with that very nicely, and it's just, it wasn't interesting
mm-hmm.
to me.
Right.
Why is that? I think I like the subtlety and ambiguity things, you know, like maybe the sexiest painting to me in art history is something where there's just the right glance from a person. It's
mm-hmm.
in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people observed that the paintings I was doing before people came into them were sexier than once people were in the paintings.
Right.
Because it was more about just, you know, material and,
mm-hmm.
I can understand that. But it's, you know, to use people as pornography, it feels heavy-handed to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you feel like there was a noticeable change in your collector-based pre- and post-using models?
Huh, that's a good question. I think I kind of don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, literally the period up to 2002, I had had, you know, two shows with Mary. And so, you know, my collector base was two shows worth of art collectors for some very small shows. So I don't feel like I could even characterize that demographic or pick out individual players so much.
Right. Right.
I think there are a few that, you know, stayed with me. But, yeah, it's a good question. I'm just not sure how to answer that.
That's fine. That's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just to sort of talk more about the question than the answer, I'm just mm-hmm. wondering if mm-hmm. a given collector sees the model come on and, you know, let's say two collectors, and collector A is, you know, is much more excited and collector B is much more turned off and, like, you know, likes the preface. So I was just wondering if there was a noticeable effect, but it doesn't sound like there has been.
I think to a more attentive person, there probably would have been. But it's been actually important for me to not pay that much attention to that side of the whole game.
Right.
You know, as much as I said, I know about the importance of being social.
Right.
In terms of, like, what I make and how it gets received out there, I really try to not think about it much because I think that's a danger that could lead to making really mediocre work.
Mm.
So when I've made big changes like this, you know, to Mary's credit, actually, Mary Boone, I have a show coming up this fall, and she does it. We don't discuss it. You know, I paint stuff that I'm painting, you know, some of which is changing considerably. And, you know, we have this relationship whereby there's no concern over losing old collectors or not gaining new ones. It's just like I have enough history, knock on wood, that I feel like if I'm excited about something enough to paint it, there's also going to be someone else excited out there that wants to live with it.
Right. And in terms of not paying attention to that exterior stuff, does that mean you don't read reviews of your shows?
Well, I wish I could say that. I don't. There's some I've never really read through.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just kind of skim a lot of them. Unfortunately, I tend to remember the really bad ones.
Sure. That's how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I can honestly say there are reviews I have not read. Oh, maybe not reviews so much as just, you know, God, actually there's some interviews I've never read.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I try not to focus on that part of my business.
Yeah.
As I say that, I think, well, that sounds really stupid. Well, you probably should, but
could Emily, for example, you know, read them and decide whether, you know, and knowingly pass them on or not pass them?
Yeah. Actually, you know, she will do that. I'll ask my girlfriend, sometimes we'll read them and she'll tell me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just ask, is there anything really embarrassing in there that I need to know about and beware of?
Right.
And she'll say no and I'll be fine.
Right. Got it. So over the arc of your being an artist or in your art career, more particularly, would you say that it's been in terms of in terms of being a working artist, being an artist who makes a living from their work, was there a particular turning point or was it rather gradual?
Pretty gradual. Yeah. In fact, it was real gradual. I was, I don't come from money. I went to Cooper Union, but it was free. I borrowed some money then to be able to live in New York City, and later paid it off. But I've always had other jobs up till really 2 years into even showing with Mary. I was still doing contracting jobs.
Oh, wow.
So the 2002 is when the last time I took a job like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I still have my tool bag. You know,
right.
Things go really south.
Right.
I could do it. Though I know now how terrible I was at it. It was gradual. I graduated in 1987. And, you know, throughout that time, I would have little shows here and there, often at certainly at places you never would have heard of. Some of them even upstate New York. I'm from New Paltz, New York, originally, and I do little shows up there. But there was always something else augmenting the income, and also me learning to live on really very little.
Sure, good for you. Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, to your point about that, I think what you said was I realized that I wasn't that great a contractor. Is that essentially what you said?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true, but I bet you could easily get work if you needed to as a photo stylist, right? Food stylist, particularly.
You know, I would say yes, except I know some people in that profession, and it's really cutthroat.
Right.
Like, if I was willing to hustle big
time.
Right. and I'm a little late in getting into the game. I know what you're saying, though.
Yeah.
It's
a good portfolio.
Like contracting skill set. Those are some skills that
right.
I've become interested in and have become important to the paintings.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
well,
I think they're pros who can really do it better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Got it. Well, that's very pragmatic and realistic of you. There's this quote that there's this line that I heard David Sedaris, who's got a new collection out, talk about on the radio recently that I wanted to apply to you, which is why I asked you that question about your arc. And I'm going to apply it anyway, even if it's not a perfect match. He talked about imagining what it would be like once he was successful, what that would be like. And in answer to that question, he said, "It's everything I imagined. It's fantastic." You know, so
how great. I love David Sedaris.
Yeah, exactly. So I just wonder if it's my presumption is because, you know, you've paid your dues and, you know, it has been rather gradual, although, you know, now you're on quite a pretty solid run. If you've ever been able to have a moment where you say to yourself, yeah, this is pretty great.
You know, I absolutely do.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And they tend to be centered around, I'll be just here at my easel in my studio, like problem solving within a painting.
Right.
And like getting something, like making a mark, finding a solution that I've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just feel this joy that I can do this.
Right.
You know, and it means things, really pragmatic, practical things, like I have a studio that I have enough money to pay for. And, you know, I have working light fixtures and, you know, enough food in my belly to keep going. It's like just those things. And I won't say that's all of it, but that's like the most meaningful part of it for sure.
Right.
Is just my studio time with myself.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, I could say that very thing. Like I think the dream I dreamed is very much what I have.
Yeah. I think that though about appreciating the work when you're in it cannot be underestimated because...
No, it can't.
Yeah,
it
I mean,
can't.
Because there are a lot of artists...
Of this,
yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry, no, just as part of this idea, because, you know, if we want to talk about, you know, maybe people dream about having their own Learjet and flying around and, you know, had that been part of my dream, I would be eternally disappointed
right.
every single day that I wake up and I don't have a jet.
Right.
You know, maybe fortunately for me, that wasn't part of my dream, remains not part of my dream.
Right.
You know, nor does having 24 houses all over the world or, you know, things like that. Like, my
right.
dream really seems to be about painting.
Yeah. And the thing that I think I want to emphasize about how important it is that you're appreciating that is that what you did not say is it's great having the glory, you know, like going to your openings and what have you and being, you know, adulated.
Yeah. Again, maybe there are people for whom that is really meaningful
right.
to me and honestly to a lot of other artists I know, that's kind of the worst part of it. You know, at least the going to the opening part.
Yeah.
Like, I think, what could I say? Like, if it's nice for me to meet people sometimes, you know, who know and appreciate my work just because it's out there. Like,
yeah.
That's very gratifying.
Right.
You know, especially if it's somewhere far away. But it, you know, I don't think that's quite the glory that we're talking about when people talk about the glory.
Right.
That's not attractive.
yeah. Good. Well, unless you have any other things that you feel we were missed that we did not get to, Will, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, you too, Michael. Thank you very much. That was a fun conversation for me.
Absolutely. And
sure.
We're out. Thank you very much again to Will for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And if there is anything that you feel like I maybe could have asked more about or did not ask, certainly feel free to let me or us know. Do write us. I do respond to all communique. I want to tell you about another little interesting communique in a second. First, I wanted to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. I do love the accolades, including Robert Grant's, but I also really love to get donations. I want to continue to thank Kate Mitchell, who has been instrumental in keeping this show going. I think you may have noticed that our guest quality is upped significantly, and we're going to keep it that way with this once every other week. So thanks to Kate for helping out. You can support her and I by making a lovely financial contribution. You can donate for as little as you can support the show for as little as $1 a month on Patreon, which is linked through the website. It's a site that's devoted to supporting entities like ours. You can also donate one time via PayPal, which is also linked through the website. Either way, your financial support is very much needed and appreciated. So thank you very much in advance for that. It's been a little slow lately, to put it mildly. So now would be a great time to dive in if you are a new listener. I did get a lovely donation from an artist in Hong Kong, an Indian artist living in Hong Kong. Thank you very much again to him for his donation. Great to know that we have listeners in Hong Kong, among other places. You can also support the show by becoming a follower on social media, all linked through the site. You can leave a nice review on iTunes so that more people can find the show. You can recommend me to other podcasts and so on. So thank you very much in advance for your support. And I want to remind you that the show I curated at Charlie James Gallery called Focus Group is still up. It's up through, I believe, the 9th or the 10th of July. Want to thank Jay Bell and Stuart Fingerhut, who are both big supporters of the podcast, for checking out the show. If you haven't checked it out, please do. If you have and you want to let me know what you think, even if it's a little bit of constructive criticism, go for it. Would love to hear it. All right, so I got another supporter of the show, an artist in Australia named Ingemar Apinis. Sorry if I'm not pronouncing your last name correctly, Ingemar. He alerted me to a fan of the show that I would not have otherwise known about. He checks out this website that does sort of artist interviews, profiles, mini profiles, what have you. And this woman, who is a Puerto Rican-born artist living in New York, he alerted me to because in the interview, she gave her favorite podcasts. And guess which art podcast she mentioned? Yes, once again, The Conversation. And by the way, if you're listening, Puerto Rican-born artist living in New York, let me know directly that you're a listener of the show. That would be awesome. And then maybe I'll give this interview a shout out, and we'll create a happy circle together. So thanks to Ingemar, and thank you to you, New York based artist listener, for listening. I appreciate it. I appreciate the shout out. What else? You know, I'm sure there are other things that I could talk about. I'm enjoying the Barry Blitt covers of The New Yorker, skewering Orange 45, as he is known, among other things. The Papaya Pinochet is another good one. And I know some of you, especially in the States, are going crazy by what's going on in our country politically. And if you want a little dose of very brief comic relief, I would recommend checking out the various Barry Blitt covers devoted to this individual. So I just got the new one in the mail today, and it is a very nice addition to the portfolio of parodies, of satires. So check those out if you have not. Art-wise, I don't have anything pressing to mention for the moment, so I will say thank you very much for listening to the show. Let me know what you thought of this episode, or any other for that matter. I appreciate your support in any way that you can give it. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.